Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Vampire Historian Podcast. This is your host, Dax Stokes, and this first episode for October 2018 is an interview with author and speaker Dacre Stoker, who runs the Stoker Estate, is the author of Dracula the Undead, co-author and also Dracul, which comes out today, October 2nd, and he also does a Stoker on Stoker lectures, has been a guest at my conference here in Texas, the World Dracula Day, and several places around the world. He also leads Romanian travel tours, and just lots of other stuff that we talk about here in this episode. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Dacre Stoker, and all the information about the book and everything is here, where you can find it, where you can find him. It's all here in the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, I'd like to welcome author Dacre Stoker to the podcast today. Thanks for being here, Dacre.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always cool to be on a guy with same initials as me and almost the same name.
That's right. Just as a very beginning anecdote, the first time I think we ever started chatting online was when I wrote an article that got published into Portuguese with your name on it because they thought you wrote it. And then somebody else
made me look good. I'll take it any day when you write it.
somebody else wrote an article then about the name mix up, but it was very meta. But we've talked online a few times, and then of course last year we had you here in Texas as our main guest for our World Dracula Day Symposium.
That was a pleasure. It was great to finally meet you. First, you put together a really neat lineup because I hadn't met some of those folks that you had brought together, and it was good fun, as well as, you know, bumping into a young man that I went to boarding school with 40 years ago. So all around it was a great time, and I thank you again for going to the trouble of putting on that conference.
Sure, so some of my listeners know a little bit about you, from various other things I've done, but just to start out, before the Dracula stuff for you is kind of a later part of your life. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you were doing before you got into the Stoker Estate?
Before Dracula, and then after I got the bug, I was a first of all, I did actually read Dracula when I was a younger guy, teenager, growing up in Montreal, Canada. We actually had a copy, a first edition copy signed by Bram on the bookshelf. And, you know, at the age of about 14, 15, my dad sort of pulled it off and said, okay, son, I need to tell you the story about how, you know, his grandfather, my great grandfather, was Bram's youngest brother, and how this book came to get in our possession. Bram gave it to his mother. His mother thought his brother Richard would like to read it. Richard is heading off to British Columbia, which is a real outpost in those days, with his wife. And he was a kind of reclusive guy, a doctor, a botanist as well. And somehow we don't exactly know how Richard Stoker gave it to Susan Stoker's wife. And then when they both passed away, a box of things arrived into Montreal, Canada, where my dad and his brother sort of split things up. And we got this really cool first edition Dracula signed by Bram to his mother, and then the other two signatures. So I'm embarrassed to say, Dax, the edition of Dracula I read at the age of 14 or 15 was a very valuable first edition.
Sure.
And I really didn't quite understand it. It was difficult reading. I didn't really get it until fast forward, I'm in university, and McNally and Florescu write In Search of Dracula, and that's sort of an easier read, but it also highlighted Bram Stoker to his own family. We really didn't know that much about him, and thank goodness.
Sure.
The scholarly world of Gothic studies and fans of the movies, you know, sort of decided to focus on Bram and Dracula. And this is when McNally and Florescu had sort of discovered in the Rosenbach Museum the Dracula notes while they were looking for a famous woodcut. And they sort of put two and two together by saying, well, it must have been Vlad Dracula that Bram was looking at, and found the name in the Whitby Library in the Wilkinson book. And sort of, you know, then it all opened up. And it opened up to us as well as, wow, you know, a lot of people think highly of Bram. We need to sort of look into this. And then I sort of got into my sporting life, which was really quite interesting. I was kind of bit by the bug of the Olympic Games, watching them in my home city of Montreal in 76. And I just fell for this sport called modern pentathlon, running, shooting, swimming, fencing, and riding, of which I spent a lot of time in San Antonio, Texas, as a Canadian, as training with the American team leading up to the 1980 Olympics. And I qualified for the Canadian team, but of course that was the year of the boycott because the Russians were in Afghanistan and, you know, the free world weren't going to go play with the Russians while they had invaded Afghanistan. So, you know, that sort of messed up my Olympic dream, but I went off and got a job as a teacher and a coach. And I realized I was probably better suited and more successful as a coach in modern pentathlon.
Sure.
I wasn't an athlete. I did end up with the young lady that I was coaching on the Canadian ladies team, coaching a world champion in 1983. And then I got the job to take the men's team to the Olympic Games in Seoul, Korea. So I did actually fulfill my Olympic dream in a way, being an Olympian as a coach.
Right.
And, you know, that was sort of, you know, the side of life, which is really far removed from the Gothic, not only a lot of time to read books or to worry too much about brand, but, you know, later in life, I got a job as a school teacher at a private school in South Carolina, where my wife is from. And I get this phone call out of the blue from Ian Holt, who is a screenwriter and had written a screenplay about sort of a sympathetic Dracula character modeled after the Gary Oldman figure, and thought that it'd be really cool that to continue that story. And so he said, well, I would love a Stoker involved, but it can't just be a sequel of a movie. It's got to be a sequel of a book, and we've got to blend them in together. And so I really didn't, you know my way navigating around the scholarly world or the popular culture world at the time. And I learned an awful lot, made some mistakes, had some fun, but learned an awful lot about the sense and sensibilities of people who are Dracula fans. And you know, Dracula the Undead was a fun story, but it offended a lot of people because we did create a Dracula character that was different than Bram's Dracula.
Right.
And we did alter the characters of the story, because of course the story does take place 25 years after Dracula ended. And it was more of a sequel of the 92 Coppola movie, because in Ian's world, that's, you know, that was the most current Dracula that was in his mind. But one of the cool things, Dax, in my research for that was I discovered the Rosenbach notes of Dracula. Since then, they've been published, thank goodness, by Miller and 18 Bassang. And actually, funnily enough, I'm working with Robert on another edition of those notes.
Oh,
so
wow.
Even I can't remember how many editions now, but there's some really new things that I have found with him, and it's coming out a little bit soon. I'm doing the introduction, but I've shared with him some of my other little secrets that I found. But I also found this journal of Bram Stoker's in an attic in one of my cousins, Bram's great-grandson's home in the Isle of Wight. And I think that's what really put me on the map, Dax, as a guy that is willing to, you know, really work hard. I aligned myself with Dr. Elizabeth Miller, who was, you know, probably the foremost expert in the world on Bram and Dracula. And she helped me decipher the lost journal, much like she did the notes. Took us about a year and a half. We published that in 2012. So at that point, the sporting life kind of took a little bit of a background, and getting, you know, sinking myself into as many conferences I can go to, learn as much as I can from people that know more, and practice my writing, and likely having good people to help me edit and so on. And so that really got me to where, you know, where I am today. Having, you know, this other project that's just about to sort of bust out October 2nd, which is the Dracula that I'm sure you want to ask me about.
Sure. Well, yeah, we'll get to that one. Kind of along with the journal and Dracula the Undead, what other, besides the new book coming out, what other books have you worked on? Because I know there's a few.
Well, yeah. There is a Icelandic edition of Dracula I wrote a preface for. Introduction with Hans de Roos. Hans is a really hardcore researcher, and we spent a lot of time in Romania together because we started doing a travel guide. We've seen a few out there, but not really as good as they should have been. And so we went to Romania together. We spent a lot of time working on different chapters, who's going to do what, and let's bring the world to Bram Stoker's Dracula. Where would you go in Ireland to see his his world, you know, his life, where he worked, where he played, where he grew up, and same with his family. Where did he research? Let's go to London and see where Bram lived and worked and so on. And where did the action in Dracula happen there? Let's go to Whitby and do the same.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Romania, which I've now been to many times, having now started leading tours there. Mm-hmm. But Hans and I have sort of gone in different directions. That work is sort of sitting in limbo. And he started a photography school in the Philippines. And he also, you know, fell on an amazing treasure, which mm-hmm. is the Icelandic edition of Dracula, which when it first came out, nobody really knew how it got there. Nobody knew until really Hans started translating it that it was a different story.
Right.
And to sort of, you know, keep this brief, my theory that it was an early draft of Dracula that Bram's either editor Otto Kalman at Archibald Constable said, you know what, this thing needs to be, you know, cleaned up, tightened up, needs to be fixed in a certain way, and which obviously Bram did for the version that we have seen. This Icelandic one is, as you probably well know, Dax, is really rough. And when the really cool sort of piece of this is when Hans translated and had this group of people help him translate it, there was this great dilemma. Why is it incomplete? It just doesn't seem that Bram, you know, took the time to polish it. There's gaps. Was it the work of the translator, who was also mm-hmm. an author, to take liberties, which a lot of times, especially in those days, a foreign translator will do to make the book more interesting, resonate with the local audience. And so there was, Hans did some great research to figure out who was Adamson, could he have done this, what was his other writings, and so on. Well, the book gets published. It's a wonderful work, well annotated. But 4, 5, 6 months after it comes out, John Browning, who did the afterword, and Hans and I got an email from this guy in Sweden, Richard Berghorn, who said, Rickard Berghorn, said, well, guys, I've solved your mystery for you. Like, what's that? Well, I know where all the gaps are. I was like, what do you mean? He said, somehow the manuscript that Bram sent over went to Sweden before it went to Iceland. Huh. And there was a strange laws in those days that is same thing in the U.S., that a foreign author to be published needed to serialize his book in a newspaper. Now, I don't know if mm-hmm. there was payment involved for doing that, but it was obviously not making nearly as much if you give this away column by column for 30 days or however many it takes to get the book in. But that's what they had to do. So for Bram to have this, his that version of Dracula, which in Icelandic was translated to the Powers of Darkness, mm-hmm. Published, it had to be put into a Swedish newspaper. And Berghorn found that newspaper.
Wow.
And he found that it was complete.
Mm-hmm.
But funnily enough, what happened was in those days, newspapers would be put into stacks, put onto a boat, and every so often, not every day, but every week or so, a stack of newspapers would head out to Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, the guys in Iceland who took it to republish it in the Iceland newspaper didn't publish the whole thing.
Right.
Either it was an error, or maybe part of the newspapers got soaking wet on the boat. They got lost mm-hmm. in the boats. But then the Asmundsen, when he published the book and he took it from the serialization from the newspaper, sort of continued the error that started somewhere, the disconnect between the Swedish newspaper and the Icelandic, and figured that was it and tried to, you know, I guess he tried to fill in some of the gaps himself.
Sure.
So it's a little bit sad that Hans, you know, I mean, he gets credit for discovering this. Berghorn gets some credit for finding the rest of it. And now many of us are waiting with bated breath. I want to read the rest of it, you know.
Right.
And I don't read Swedish. And apparently there's an effort being made to get it translated. So mm-hmm. long-winded, but that was a really cool find I was involved in. And the travel journal is sort of sitting in limbo. And one of the reasons is I keep going back to Romania and finding cool things. Like since I've seen you, and I know I've mentioned to you about Mount Israel, I actually climbed it with my son and a guy.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a cool experience. I've also been to Cruden Bay, and I've been corresponding with a writer over there who has been researching Bram's time in Cruden Bay. Wow. And you may see him on Facebook. If you're not, you should connect with him, knowing how keen you are. His name is Mike Shepard. And I've written the introduction to his book, which is called When Brave Men Shudder. And he has done incredible accurate research to find that Bram Stoker spent 13 summers there.
Wow.
Not just the one or two that many of the biographers, you know, from a distance, they sort of said, yeah, Bram went to Whitby in 1890, spent a two-week holiday there, based chapters 6, 7, 8 there. And he then went on to Cruden Bay, where he spent some time, did his writing. Well, I don't want to steal the thunder from Mike, but he's got definitive proof that Bram Stoker spent 13 summers there. He knows where he stayed. He's got newspaper articles. He's got things signed in different books. He knows that Bram wrote Water's Mow, Mystery of the Sea, and most likely Dracula there. Mm-hmm. And one thing I love to point out, it solved a bit of a mystery to me, because you remember the Jane Stoddard article that when she said to Jane, when she said to Bram, that, now this was 3 months after Dracula came out, the only interview that we know Bram gave about Dracula, how long did you take to write it?
Mm-hmm.
He said, it's been in my mind for a long time, but about 3 years. And that kind of stumped a lot of scholars, because we know his notes spanned about a 7-year period.
Right.
But the actual writing,
he
said about 3 years. And we know he started going to Cruden Bay in 1893. So if it took him 3 years from 1893 to 96, then the book came out in 1897.
Yeah.
So Mike Shepard has figured out that Bram was spent 13 summers there, that the 3 of those years he spent writing Dracula. And he walked me around the areas where Bram walked and stopped in certain places and would read passages from each of the 3 books and describe certain things in particular, like a certain rock face, a certain Coast Guard station. But the one that was just the coolest Dracula connection was Slane's Castle. And I had always kind of like, oh, Slane's Castle. You know, Bram did this, you know, he was focusing on Transylvania. What do you mean by Slane's Castle? How the Scottish trying to grab some of that? Well, Mike said, Dacre, come here with an open mind. And in chapter 1, there is a description of Jonathan Harker arriving into the castle, the Count meeting him, picking up his bag, and walking him into an octagonal room lit with one light. And he described the room had no windows to the outside. You would not believe it, but Slane's Castle has that exact room.
Wow.
And now that people are flying drones over the top of it, some of the interesting things that happen in England and Scotland and Ireland is if you can't pay tax on the place, you take the roof off. Of course, you got to take everything else out because it'll be ruined, but you don't have to pay tax on a ruin.
Right.
And so you can see from above this perfect octagonal room. That is not connected to the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was over there with Mike and I was giving a one of the Stoker on Stoker presentations that you've seen me give out last year at World Dracula Day, of course, I was putting some things in with Mike's help to show some local slides. And I included that octagonal room and the mention of the one light. And a very distinguished gentleman who was there with 4 other people stood up and said, "That's my light." Scottish guy, you know, sort of in his 70s. And everybody's looking and go, he says, "My name is Angus so-and-so. My family used to own the castle. We saved that light, and I've got it in London. I'll send you a photo of it." So that photo is going to be in Mike Shepard's book.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, you asked me sort of, and I'm sorry I'm rambling, but,
no, sure.
You know, I dig. I get opportunistic. I, you know, spend the money to go there and do the research and meet people. And you just begin to find more pieces of this puzzle that come back together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm now convinced more than ever that Bram's style in writing this book and choosing locations for things, choosing the parts of the castle, he may have looked at the picture of Brand Castle in the Charles Bonner book or the Macchiarelli book. And we may know that it was actually 400 miles to the north of the country in the Borgo Pass, not in Brasov, but that he actually took a room he was familiar with, because Mike is convinced that Bram actually went into Slane's castle when it was fully furnished and had a roof on it when he was there. And so he just, you know, took little bits and pieces like a painter would, you know, putting a nice big composition together. So I'm sure that that's, you know, that was what he did. And so I've got to continue my work on this guidebook, but now include a lot about
sure.
Bruden Bay and so on. So that's why that's not finished. And, I'll get to it once sort of pressure from Dracul is off.
Right. Well, you mentioned your Stoker on Stoker presentations, and you've done those are always evolving, right? I know that when I saw you last year, you had just been to see Paul Allen's manuscript, and so you just added some stuff in. So can you maybe talk a little bit about how that came together and how you got to do that?
Well, that's a segue into Dracul, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'd always heard about this typescript, which is a manuscript that is typed. Mm-hmm. Les Klinger wrote about it in his book. Apparently Gordon Melton has seen it, and Robert H.E. Bassang has seen it. And it was like, I've got to see this. Paul Murray, the Dublin-based biographer, his theory is that Bram Stoker delivered his typescript to Thomas Donaldson, who is a lawyer and close friend of Walt Whitman, sort of benefactor near the end of his life. Whitman had died at that point. Bram was crossing the Atlantic 8 times to go with the Lyceum Theater, and he would visit Whitman occasionally when he was able to do so, when his trips were up in the New Jersey area, Pennsylvania, New Jersey area. And Bram was really enamored with Abraham Lincoln. And Walt Whitman gave lectures on Abraham Lincoln. And so Donaldson delivered to Bram, as the favor to Whitman, the Lincoln notes. And Bram took those notes and gave lectures on it. And it might be the University of Texas. There's somewhere, Dax, that actually has the you know, his copies of these lectures. So... You know, Bram wanted to give something of great value in return to Mr. Donaldson, because he knew that to carry out Whitman's wish to deliver those notes was a big deal. I mean, Donaldson didn't ever have to say anything, could have kept those notes. Bram would never been the wiser, but he decided. Now, why we know that is that about 3-4 decades later, the Dracula typescript shows up in a Pennsylvania barn in a trunk that was owned by a series of the Donaldson family.
Wow.
And when the last one was ready to clear house and move out, they checked out the barn, found this trunk, and there was this stack of papers with a string around them, and found that this was, you know, holy smokes, this is the you know, the typescript of Dracula is pretty valuable, and it went sort of along the chain and went up being auctioned, and it ended up, thank goodness, in somebody like Paul Allen's hands, who allows authors to come study it, and he also allows certain, I think, 5 or 6 pages on rotation to be on display at the Museum of Popular Culture. J.D. Barker and I needed to see that. We wanted, because the story we have written, it's coming out October 2nd, is a prequel to Dracula. And we wanted to figure out what was Bram's original beginning of the story. Where did it actually start? And one of the mystiques of the typescript is the numbering is pretty haphazard, but we see a number 102 on page 1 of the typescript. So there's obviously 101 pages missing.
Well,
one of the clues that was in that supposedly in that, that I feel confident, as I mentioned at your World Dracula Day conference, is Dracula's Guest.
Right.
Bram's widow published Dracula's Guest 2 years after Bram died. And she wrote in the preface to that, that here's a series of short stories from my husband. One of them, called Dracula's Guest, was excised due to length of mm-hmm. my husband's most famous story. So, something close to that. And so it made sense that she wouldn't be lying. She would have known. But also, when you read Dracula's Guest, and if any of your listeners have it, you can get it for free and look on Project Gutenberg. It's a cool short story, 17 pages approximately, and it's very much a Jonathan Harker-type character who's not right. named. And he's en route to, on the train ride, to Transylvania, and he stops for a day in Munich. Mm-hmm. And his adventures, or misadventures, let's say, in that one right. day, really are an encounter with a vampire in a sort of this strange little town with nobody living in it, and it happens on Walpurgis Night, mm-hmm. Which is a sort of Halloween kind of night in Scandinavia, Germany, those places where the spirits kind of come out, and the driver of the carriage that the Harker character is taking a tour in stops at a crossroad and will go no further. And that's the first hint mm-hmm. because in those days, in certain parts of the world, crossroads are where suicides are buried, and suicides by superstition and folklore turned into vampires. Vampires mm-hmm. are, apparently they're OCD or something. And if, right. if they try to come out of the grave at a crossroads, they're not going to go anywhere. They'd be going in circles. So long story short, it makes great sense to many researchers and now myself that I've seen it, that Dracula's Guest is referenced in three other places in the rest of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. So by looking at the typing and following through very closely and looking at the lines that were crossed out, I found these three references to the story that's no longer there. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very obvious. One of them was the now Jonathan Harker character says, "My throat is sore, like the razor-like tongue of the wolf." Mm-hmm. And so the very end of Dracula's Guest, he's got sort of this hypothermic condition and he's lying down and the wolf comes in and doesn't kill him, lays down on top of him, provides warmth and licks his throat. Mm-hmm. Obviously that's where they're like. And then the other one is he has this kind of weird kind of dream state, didn't sleep very well, had a bad sleep, much like the Dead House in Munich, and the crypts were also, the morgues and crypts were called the Dead House, and they mentioned on Walpurgis Night. And then he also mentioned this woman in white at the grave in Walpurgis Night. So it was quite obvious that that's what Bram was kind of pointing to. So JD and I need to figure a way, when we create this prequel to Dracula, that it ends at the original beginning. Mm-hmm. And we had to obviously take some leaps. What else was in those other pages? If there was 101 missing and 17 we found as Dracula's Guest, there's obviously still some more out there.
Sure.
It's very likely that it's Jonathan Harker leaving England and an adventurous train ride, and his editor probably said, we don't need all that. Let's right. hurry up and get him closer to there. Because as you know, the action really gets exciting, not just on a train ride as he's wondering, ooh, what's it going to be like when I get to Transylvania? Mm-hmm. Let's let the action start when the Count picks him up the suitcase and drops it off in the octagonal room, and then the real fun begins.
So how did you, then moving into the book, how did you get together with J.D. Barker? Because, different co-author this time. How did you kind of get in touch with him? He's a little bit more of an established horror author.
I felt that doing Stoker on Stoker for so long, I felt I had a story in the works, but I needed mm-hmm. somebody with some experience to help put it all together. That was sort of, I was on the look. I had an outline, about 30 pages, and it was based on a couple of things, Dax, that you won't be too surprised about, because I talk a little bit about it in Stoker on Stoker. And number one is, being the athletic coach that I was during the 80s, there was a lot of steroid use going on, a lot of performance enhancing drugs going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Lance Armstrong was a hero.
Sure.
But we all suspected something because, you know, he had made this amazing recovery from cancer. You know, these drugs obviously had a great impact on his body. And then he trained like an animal. But, you know, we all suspected something else going on. And I thought, what happened to Bram's childhood illness, which was mysterious and never diagnosed?
Mm-hmm.
But at the age of 7, he was able to not only be normal again and get out of bed and live somewhat of a normal life, but he grew to be huge, 2 inches taller than anybody in the family, and grew to be a real stud of an athlete. I mean, he was mm-hmm. a champion of all-around athletics at Trinity. He was a champion race walker, a rugby player, gymnastics, I mean, all kinds of things. So it's like this little, you know, in my mind, I was thinking, well, what happens if maybe he had some sort of weird concoction? And you know, we, as I said, I knew about human growth hormone and blood doping. Well, let's mm-hmm. play with this a little bit. You know, maybe there's some vampire blood or some druid concoction, you know, something that could make Bram, you know, really strong. But whenever that happens in life, you know, you got to pay the piper somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, you know, there's this old saying, and we'll get it right, but, you know, you sort of, if you're going to play with the devil, you know, you owe him an offering. And so in mm-hmm. this case, the idea would be Bram's going to have an interaction with a vampire, and mm-hmm. this is going to change his life. And then at some time, he's going to write Dracula as if a warning to the rest of the world, going, you know what? I did this when I was younger, and I'm not proud of it. And now I've got to warn the rest of you. Because I thought, you know, as we writers do, if Bram Stoker really felt vampires were real, and I've got a sense that he was somewhat convinced that a heck of a lot of people believe that vampires were real in many
right.
cultures. You very well know about. So how could, you mm-hmm. know, hundreds of thousands of people in many different countries have this in their folklore and mythology and there not be some semblance of truth there? If he did, and he decided to go and be the good guy that he was and tell the Scotland Yard or the Dublin police, they would have thought he was a whack job and put him in an mm-hmm. insane asylum, and he wouldn't have been helping the cause. So this story is about the what if.
Mm-hmm.
What if he and his brother and his sister and others in the family had to deal with this threat of a mm-hmm. real vampire. And then it sort of starts when Bram is born in 1847 and moves on. And I'll get to the rest of the story in a moment. But the original question was, I found J.D. Barker because he wrote a book called Forsaken. It's his first book. And in that book, he was up for Horror Writers' Best First Book Award, and I was presenting it that year.
Oh, wow.
So I felt it was good of me to read some of those books. Well, mm-hmm. I have to say, I stopped at Forsaken because it really it spoke to me, because he utilized a journal. It's more of a witch story mm-hmm. that came to life. And I'd been thinking about the Bram Stoker notes, the typescript. They're telling me something, and it's like J.D. Barker was somewhere in the same plane that I was mm-hmm. without even knowing each other, the way he used this journal. And the funny thing is, in his story, the author's wife in the story picked up the journal at a store called Needful Things.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen King. So J.D. has a lot of guts to go forward, and he mm-hmm. finally got to Stephen King through Jack Ketchum, who gave him his email address and introduction, and J.D. got permission to keep the name of the Needful Things in there. And I thought, well, that guy's got the guts to do that. I need to meet him. And he also had another character in the story, which if I tell you, it'll be too much of a spoiler, but another character that was like, my gosh, he's on to something.
Mm.
So I met him at Horror Writers. I pitched him an idea of collaboration. And interesting enough, he was ready for that. Because he had done some ghostwriting, he had just done Forsaken. He was on his, he was working on Fourth Monkey at the time, which is now a big hit,
mm-hmm.
And CBS has bought it as a series. So I was sort of lucky to get the guy on the upswing of his arc, and
sure.
He was just a thrill to work with. We shared writing, we bounced ideas back and forth. He's got the dominant voice because he's the established writer,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of my thoughts went into it, a lot of my writing went into it, with a lot of his editing, and mostly my wife and I did all the research to create a timeline of the actual timeline of the Stoker family and all the Stoker members that are in that in the story to make sure it works with our overall story arc. So JD is, you know, as soon as he finished this the first draft, and I had to work on a lot of edits, he's off writing Fifth to Die, which is the sequel to Fourth Monkey, and which is out now. Came out in July, and so he's this, you know, got this really great thriller sort of suspense to him, and I bring in the horror, and so this Dracul is a little bit of everything, and the you know, early readers on Goodreads and so on, it's like, wow, this is more than just a regular Dracula horror. It's a suspense thriller with the sort of the Dracula vampire to it. So I'm confident not only was he a great pleasure to work with, but he brought so much to it that I could never have done on my own.
Sure. Is without giving too much away, is this story going to fit in at all with Dracula the Undead also? Since Graham was a character there.
It could. I mean, we definitely thought of that, like it's a cool trilogy, but we decided to write it in the epistolary style, which of course Dracula the Undead is not.
Right.
That's one of the negative feedbacks from Dracula the Undead was we changed the style of writing. How dare you the sequel? And so we said, well, we heard you loud and clear. Dracul is in epistolary style. It's in journals. Newspaper articles, it's letters. Mm-hmm. And so I still can't change Dracula the Undead. If I had a way to do it, I'd go back and put it to epistolary, but that's how we've done Dracul and we love it. It was harder to make sure that everything lined up and all the different perspectives, but it was well worth it.
Sure. Great. So that book is going to be released next week. And I'm going to release this on the day. So it'll be released. This podcast will come out on October 2nd, so the book will be out that day, and people can get it. One of the other big projects that kind of wrapped up for you earlier this year, still sort of in relation to Paul Allen, is the Bram Stoker Bust Project. I thought maybe you could just talk a little bit about how that came to be.
Yes. Really proud that Brian Moore, the artist, we were actually able to get two of them made, if you can believe it. It was tough sledding to get the first one done, but that was destined to Paul Allen's Museum of Popular. Well, it's not his museum; he's a big benefactor. But the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle is the home of one of the Bram Stoker bronze busts, and they've got a really cool exhibit going on called "Scared to Death: Vampires in Movies." And so if any of your listeners are ever going anywhere near Seattle, I highly recommend it. They've got some really cool exhibit with items from lots of different film sets. And of course the Dracula bust is sitting right next to some of Bram's typescript, which is neat. And the family, you know, kind of got in at the last moment. My extended family gave money so we could get another one made and delivered over to the Dublin Writers Museum. Mm-hmm. And I went over with my wife and my two children. We were planning a visit to Ireland where we actually uncovered some interesting, cool stuff about my great-grandfather. But part of it was to be there for the unveiling, and it was wonderful that Noel Dobbs, a great-grandson, was there. Carlotta Di Fiorio, my cousin, who is a daughter of my uncle, Patrick Stoker, who was sort of the genealogist in the family who passed away a few years ago. She came over with her daughter. So it's a good family gathering. Mm-hmm. And now I can say, Dax, when people go to Dublin, there is a bronze bust at the Dublin Writers Museum, and there's another bust that another cousin made. It's not bronze, but it's in the St. Anne's Church where Bram was married. And there's another one on Tarf at Bram's Cafe. Oh, wow. So Bram, he's now getting a nice presence in both his home city as well as at a wonderful museum. So that was really happy that happened to be. And Brian is a wonderful artist. He's just completed a Mary Shelley bust.
Right.
And Mary Shelley is going to end up in Museum of Popular Culture as well. Mm-hmm. So, as Brian said, the godmother and the godfather of horror, rightfully side by side in MoPop.
And he has a really good Vlad the Impaler bust as well that he did that I've seen. So,
yeah,
that's some good work. So, what kind of things? So, you've got projects like that and kind of helping with the books, but what does the Stoker Estate kind of do now? Are there any other kind of projects they work on or help people with research or things like that?
Well, number one, we know that Dracul is going to bring lots of attention to Bram Stoker and his family, and so we needed to ramp this up because, as you know, if things go well with the book, then Paramount exercises their option and makes the movie, and then you know lots of emphasis on the Stoker and the Stoker Estate. And so we've been revamping the website. I just had my own website made, a brand new one, dacrestoker.com. So we're trying to be, continue to be a clearinghouse, help people with research, get information that, share it with other people. There's lots of it's funny how little things kind of come our way. There was two guys from San Francisco that came on a tour of mine this summer to Romania, and I didn't even know people like this existed. But much like a sommelier with wine or a tea taster, one of the guys was a perfumer or a parfum. Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting, serious stuff. And he came on the trip because he's really into the Gothic, and he makes sort of very boutique type perfume and wanted to bring some samples back, smell things, do some research on Transylvania.
Wow.
And create some perfumes, different perfumes that have some of the elements of these different places we visit. So the Bram Stoker Estate is planning to work with him and endorse this product and, get a little bit return, but just sort of, help put Bram in the marketplace.
Wow.
Appropriate things. Still working with Anthony Taylor, who is a good friend of mine, that is the guy that runs Monsterama in Atlanta in a couple of weeks, and he's our licensing agent, and he constantly finds little deals where people are interested, somebody that does a horror box that has something that is Dracula,
sure,
Bram-esque. I'm working with a guy called Jason Figgis, who is a Irish filmmaker of Dublin, who just did a really nice documentary on the British photographer who worked in infrared light called Sir Simon Marsden. And I highly recommend your listeners just Google Sir Simon Marsden, Jason Figgis. That's the type of documentary that I'd like to tell. It's Jason and I have been discussing, and he saw one of my Stoker on Stokers, and he thought, we need to turn this into a documentary. Some of the interesting places you've been and cool things you found that are very visual. And so that's another project that, they all take time. Some of them take more money than others. Sometimes people ask a little bit for them. Sometimes we've got to raise money to pay for them, like the busts and the films. But it's interesting, and I meet lots of cool people as I do it. The other thing I'd like to do is I've been putting together collection of artifacts that the family's involved in. And I think I've mentioned to you that I helped bring some of these things to Milan, Italy, and Taiwan, Taipei in Taiwan for exhibits. And recently I've been contacted by a group of people in Finland who are putting on an exhibit in February. And so I've been negotiating with my cousins, the great-grandsons, for some of Bram's artifacts, as well as some of the books that I've accumulated to bring over there as part of a big Vampire in Art exhibit, movies, all sorts of art. One of the neat things I've done that they're interested in is it's been fun for me to try to collect some of the books that Bram has listed as his research books. So I'm trying to get first editions of that, which is quite costly, so I'm doing it slowly. But Dax, I just came across the Charles Bonner book, sitting right up here, Transylvania, Its Products and Its People. And, you know, that's one of the books where Bram saw a sketch of Bran Castle.
Right.
So, you know, like in his notes, Bram took passages from all these books and stuck them in his Dracula notes, but only 125 pages are there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking the time to read the rest of the books.
Right.
See what else could have influenced Bram, which I really won't know for sure because he didn't put in his notes. That's where Elizabeth Miller slapped me in the hand and said, if you didn't write it down, you can't be sure.
Right.
But you have a pretty good idea that Bram would have read the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Bonner book, one of the neatest things I found is in the back, there's this beautiful map. And this is the first edition, so it's old and delicate.
Mm-hmm.
And you open up this book, and it's got the lines of longitude and latitude, and there it is, just like in the notes, at exactly the way the notes show you, Mount Israel and Kalamanalui National Park. That's his mountain. And mm-hmm. right next to it is the words Borgo Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Is it's a book obviously written by an English guy. Otherwise he would have written it in Romanian. He was
right.
So I am sure now that this is a map that Bram used to create those coordinates to find Mount Israel,
mm-hmm.
Which, as I said at the beginning of this show, after this tour that I was on with the perfumers and the others, my son and I and a guide and another Romanian fellow, and he had two friends over who were peppered on university students. One was a Navy SEAL, former mm-hmm. Navy SEAL, and the other was a guy visiting from China. And we climbed up this mountain.
Wow.
And it was very cool because, I mean, we couldn't have written the story better. It was a misty kind of wet day in June. 2.5 hours to go up about this steep. It mm-hmm. was not easy, no trail. And it was, some of it was in dense forest, others was in a clear cut. But mm-hmm. the clear cut had all these little stubs of old trees sticking up. So it was a little bit dangerous and slippery as we were going up. And the clouds finally lifted when we were near the top. And it was tough going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not kidding when it looked to me like the rock face, like that ice wall in Game of Thrones. It mm-hmm. just had that look, oh my God, we're here. And obviously what I'm seeing is part of the cone of the old volcano.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mount Israel Kalamanalui is a portion of a big mountain range that was one huge caldera
mm-hmm.
of a volcano. So that was impressive. And it's like, God, that looks just like a great place for a Dracula castle. I know Bram never saw this,
mm-hmm.
but it's it. So we get to the top. And, you know, I put a little, like a time capsule. I had a special thermos with some notes in it with different languages. It's, if you ever get here, here's my email address.
Mm-hmm.
Send me this and, you know, I'll send you a sign. because this does come to play in the end of Dracul.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to put a plug for that. But we had a big decision to make. It was now about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and we needed to come down. And I just felt that our group was, you know, not capable. We're capable, but if somebody slipped and landed on Staub, we're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, you know, we also decided to walk out around the rim, which ended up taking us 4 more hours.
Yeah.
And then we got to a dirt road mm-hmm. and we knew where a weather station was. We walked 2 more miles to the weather station and our guide was a former high altitude mountain guy who is a meteorologist, so he knows where these mm-hmm. places are. Went in and we were you know, we weren't in danger, but we would have liked a little ride home at this point. You have a car,
sure.
We you know, shuttle back and forth. He goes, well, it's 10 miles. So had we decided to walk out, we would have been home by 9 o'clock at night. Weather was coming in, it would have been dark.
Mm-hmm.
So we were vulnerable. We felt so Jonathan Harker-ish, it was unbelievable. and then it got even better because he said, but no worry, this friend of mine's coming and he's bringing some supplies. And this guy shows up in a beat up old Jeep with a friend of his in the front seat, sitting in the only two seats in the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
The back of it is covered, but it's, you know, it's got room for all his old equipment. And there was 5 of us.
Mm-hmm.
So after we pleaded, would you drive us out? He goes, oh, but first, like any good Eastern European, we must drink.
Right.
As you know, you don't return. You don't turn that down.
Mm-hmm.
You've been over to that part of the world well enough. And so we sat down and drank lots of Palinka and sausage and smoked fat and bread. And the two guys who were driving their cars, they could take one little sip and then they said no more drinking because they knew that to drive. So me, my son, the Navy SEAL and the Chinese guy, we had to drink. And I don't drink this sort of stuff. And it didn't sit very well with me. So I had probably the worst 10 miles of being a little bit drunk and a little bit sick in my stomach to get out. And it was perfect though, because if it worked too smoothly. And then the very end of the story is the guy that took us out turned out to be the former head of security of this whole national park. And his best friend, his old boss, is the head of the park. And he said, tomorrow you come to my bed and breakfast, and I'll show you a much easier trail to go to the top of the mountain and back again.
Wow.
And my friend will be there, the head of the park, which he was. And he said, we will name this the Bram Stoker Trail and we'll have a plaque. So what started off, you know, as our own little three-hour tour at Gilligan Island ended up with this epic journey. And now we're going to actually, you know, sort of codify this thing. I'm going to go back next year and we'll actually do this a little bit better and easier now that I've blazed the trail so more tourists can go in a less sort of drastic and dangerous method.
Great. Well, so kind of to end everything, why don't you tell everybody, can they find pretty much everything on your website now, or in your tours and the books and everything in one place?
Thank you for asking that, because finally they can. That was the whole idea is it's you know, the appearances that I do doing Stoker and Stoker, the TV shows that I've been on, the tours and the book info, DakerStoker.com has got all that information. You can contact me right on it. I think I've kind of come out of the Stone Age. Besides my Facebook page where people can contact me, go to the website and connect with me and, you know, follow the exploits of Dracul. It's, I think Dax, people are going to, they really enjoy getting to know Bram Stoker a little bit better, and that's the whole idea. Him and his sister Matilda, his brother Thornley, that was a big part of my goal, was to sort of, you know, highlight the Stokers and how they may have come about to write Dracula as if it's a real warning to the world.
Great. Well, thanks for taking out the time, and hopefully the book's getting a lot of great press already. So hopefully your launch next week today we'll go as well as we hope.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me, and keep your good work going, and maybe we'll see each other again at a World Dracula Day somewhere.
Sure.
And until then, you know, take care and good night.
Thanks.
Once again, thanks for listening to that special interview with Dacre Stoker. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate and review on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. You can now find us on Spotify. You can listen at thevampirehistorian.com. And you can always email me at thevampirehistorian@gmail.com or follow on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, even Tumblr, Pinterest, any of those things for Vamp Historian or The Vampire Historian. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.